John, thanks so much for joining us today. I'm jetting off on holiday to Canada with my family on Friday. I'm doing a series of discussions about what I think are really good books, Glenn Dees and various other people besides. But I wanted to talk about, everybody, of course, knows you about your book on the Israel lobby, of course, and your super viral lecture from 11 years ago about the kind of primrose path that Ukraine has been taking. But actually, there's another book you've written, which is called The Great Delusion, Liberal Dreams and International Realities. And it's, as you say, it's theoretical to its core, but I think it's a colossal work. And I think it should be a textbook for anybody who follows, you know, my podcast, Glenn's, Danny Davis's, and of course, your new podcast, which you've just started up on YouTube as well, I see, John. I wanted to start, I'll only read from the book once, but I wanted to start firstly with a quote quite early on in the book. And you say that liberal hegemony will not achieve its goals and its failure will inevitably come with huge costs. The liberal state is likely to end up fighting endless wars, which will increase rather than reduce the level of conflict in international politics. Moreover, the state's militaristic behavior is almost certain to end up threatening its own liberal values. Liberalism abroad leads to illiberalism at home. Now, this was written in 2018, prior both to the war in Ukraine starting and, of course, you know, now the war in Iran. I mean, you're almost like the Nostradamus of realism, John. I mean, what inspired you to kind of really get this into the public consciousness, to kind of really get people thinking about the importance of realism and restraint?
Well, I think what happened after the Cold War ended is that the United States found itself in a unipolar system. We called it the unipolar moment. And that meant that there was, by definition, no great power politics possible because there was only one great power. So you didn't have rival great powers like the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War, or today in the multipolar world that we live in, where you have competition between the United States, China, and Russia. That was not possible in the unipolar moment. There was no great power competition. And what that allowed the unipole to do, the United States, was to pursue a liberal foreign policy. And it was commonly called liberal hegemony. And the basic goal of that foreign policy, which was in place during the unipolar moment from roughly 1992 to 2017. In those years, the United States basically tried to remake the world in its own image. We first of all concentrated on spreading liberal democracy all across the planet. We wanted to make states look like the United States, look like Western Europe. And of course, we viewed ourselves as the good guys. And if the world was populated by nothing but good guys, we would live happily ever after. And this view was underpinned by Frank Fukuyama's very famous piece, The End of History, which said that we were inexorably marching toward a planet that was populated by nothing but liberal democracies. So liberal hegemony was designed to speed up that process and to create a world of nothing but liberal democracies. That was the first goal. The second goal was to enhance economic interdependence, or to put it in slightly different terms, globalization. The idea was to get every state in the international system hooked on capitalism and to integrate them into this highly interdependent economic system that the United States sat at the heart of. So number one, we're promoting democracy all over the planet. And number two, we're fostering economic interdependence, and to put it in slightly different terms, the spread of capitalism. And then the third goal was to create powerful institutions and to integrate states all over the world into those institutions so that they would become responsible stakeholders. In other words, they would have a stake in the global order and they would be socialized to obey the rules. And if states obey the rules of institutions, again, you'll have a much more stable, a much more prosperous system. So again, the basic aim with liberal hegemony was to do social engineering and create liberal democracy here, there, and everywhere. Number two, foster economic interdependence, integrate all states into this globalized economic world. And then number three, rely very heavily on international institutions and the rules that underpin those institutions to produce a lot of responsible stakeholders. That was the basic goal. And as you can tell from listening to me talk, it required a highly interventionist foreign policy. And the United States actually pursued a highly interventionist foreign policy during the unipolar moment. And I argued from the beginning, as most realists did, that this was going to lead to unending trouble and that we were going to end up in the forever wars and we were going to lose those wars. And moreover, it was going to undermine liberalism at home because we were going to end up with highly militarized societies. And if you ask me, that's exactly what's happened. And again, I want to emphasize that this was all possible because of unipolarity. It was all possible because of the fact that we were in a world where there was no great power competition. Basic balance of power politics, basic realpolitik was taken off the table. In the bipolar world that you and I were born into of the Cold War, right, you had to pay attention to balance of power politics above all else. And the idea of pursuing a liberal foreign policy was subordinated to pursuing balance of power politics. And the same thing is true today. The war in Iran is not liberal hegemony. It has nothing to do with liberal hegemony. The United States isn't talking about spreading liberal democracy to Iran. That was the kind of talk that we had during the unipolar moment, which was a unique period in American history. And the end result was disastrous, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting reading your book, The Great Delusion, that actually kind of it was written after the first Trump administration had started. But because it was so fresh, you avoid sort of commenting on the performance of the Trump administration. So you're leaving your remarks to kind of administrations prior to that time. But I mean, fast forward to kind of 2025. I mean, is there a hint of John Mearsheim in the US national security strategy, which came out in November of last year, since largely abandoned, it seems, through actual events, which emphasizes the domination of the Western Hemisphere? It's a term actually that you use in the book. I mean, how have, you know, for a brief moment, it felt like sort of, your wise words were kind of landing, but how have kind of foreign policymakers in DC lost sight of your prescription so quickly, seemingly?
Well, it's very important to understand that I argue that the unipolar moment was from roughly 1992. Remember, the Soviet Union collapses in December 91. The Cold War ends in the fall of 1989. And then in December 91, the Soviet Union disappears. And that's when I believe we move into the unipolar moment. My argument is also that the unipolar moment ends in 2017, roughly 2017. You can't put a precise date on when it ends, but I think 2017 is a good date. And of course, 2017 is when President Trump comes into office the first time. It's in January of 2017. Now, one might think that I believe that President Trump is responsible for putting an end to unipolarity. I don't believe that at all. What put an end to unipolarity was the rise of China and Vladimir Putin bringing Russia back from the dead, so that Russia, by about 2017, was a great power, and China was a great power by about 2017. So the fact is that Trump coming into power in 2017 is coterminous with us moving into a multipolar world and leaving unipolarity in the rearview mirror. Now, it's very important to understand that Trump ran against liberal hegemony. He explicitly ran against liberal hegemony. And in his first term in office, he did not engage in any policies that look like liberal hegemony. And in fact, the Trump administration, in its first administration, the Trump administration the first time around, emphasized that we lived in a multipolar world and great power politics was back on the table. They explicitly said that, which I thought was true. And Trump, as I say, was not very adventurous on the foreign policy front. And when he got elected in 2024 and started his second term in January of 2025, we did not expect him to be adventurous. He said that no more forever wars, no more social engineering, no more regime change. And furthermore, Ian, I would say that if you look at November 2025 National Security Strategy, this is the key document of the Trump administration. It looks like a very realist document. I don't like a lot of the language that is used in the document. There's some hot language, and the administration is taking shots at different people and so forth and so on. But I think the basic template that you find in that document is consistent with my worldview. However, if you look at what Trump has done in the wake of taking office for a second time, it does not square with what is in the national security strategy. And it does not square with what he said during the 2024 campaign. And he said after he immediately after he took office in January 2025. And in fact, he's gotten into the business of using military force quite liberally, not for liberal purposes, mind you, but quite liberally. And what happened in Venezuela is one example of that. His threats to take Greenland is another example of that. But of course, most importantly is Iran. And you want to remember, he's fought two wars with Iran. We fought a war against Iran. It was very brief in June of 2025 with the Israelis. And then on February 28th of this year, he started the war against Iran that is ongoing. And this second war is clearly designed, in my opinion, let me put it differently, was clearly designed for the purpose of regime change. He engaged in a policy that he said he was not going to engage in. Now, you may say to yourself, John, isn't this just a resurrection of liberal hegemony? Aren't we back to where we were during the unipolar moment? And I would say the answer is no, because there's no evidence that he is interested in spreading liberal democracy to Iran or any other country. In fact, as we all know, Trump doesn't really like liberal democracy. I would argue that he's basically an enemy of liberal democracy, right? What he's doing is trying to work with the Israelis to foster regime change in Iran, or at least that's what he was trying to do. That ship has left the port, right? That's not possible anymore, at least in the context of the ongoing war. But he was interested in regime change, and if anything, if they could go beyond regime change, and when I say they, I mean the Israelis and the Americans, and break Iran apart, that would have been the ideal strategy. But he's, again, Trump is not interested in spreading liberal democracy, so this is not liberal hegemony at work. This is mindless social engineering. This is picking the kind of fight that the United States should stay out of. This is like going into Vietnam in 1965, right? These are wars that you're guaranteed to lose. And not to get too carried away here, Ian, but the point that I would make to you is that whether you're in the Cold War and you go into Vietnam, or you're in multipolarity and you go into Iran, or you're in the unipolar moment and you go into Afghanistan, or you go into Iraq. Just think about those conflicts. Vietnam is in bipolarity. Afghanistan and Iraq are in unipolarity, and Iran is in multipolarity. But you're doomed in all four cases, regardless of whether you're pursuing liberal hegemony or not. The point is, any time that you try to do social engineering at the end of a rifle barrel in countries around the world that you view as weak and easy to manipulate, you're going to find out that you're delusional and that you are going to run into a buzzsaw. And that buzzsaw is basically nationalism. Nationalism is the most powerful political ideology on the planet. If you look at the world today, it is populated by nothing but nation states. Nation states are the embodiment of nationalism. And nationalism, at its core, is all about self-determination. It's all about sovereignty. And what this means is that the Vietnamese, the Afghanis, and the Iranians want to determine their own politics. They don't want the United States of America, or any other country for that matter, interfering in their politics and telling them what it should look like, or what their politics should look like. So you go into a country like Vietnam, as we did in 1965, and all sorts of people are saying, we're having difficulty defeating the communists, right? The problem here is communism. The reason the Vietnamese are fighting so forcefully against us is because of communism. People believed that at the beginning of the war. I was one of those fools. But as the war wore on, almost everybody came to understand that you were not up against Vietnamese communism. You were up against Vietnamese nationalism. The Vietnamese fought against the Japanese when they occupied the country. They fought against the French when they occupied the country, and indeed defeated the French at Dien Bien Phu in 1954. And they had no intention of letting the United States take over the politics of their country. They were willing to die in huge numbers to prevent that from happening. The Soviets found that out in Afghanistan. The British found it out in Afghanistan before the Soviets. And we found it out in Afghanistan after the Soviets did. You don't want to go into a place like Afghanistan and think you could do social engineering. And again, the same thing is true with regard to Iran. And what's amazing about President Trump is that he seemed to clearly understand this. And he certainly acted according to the basic worldview I'm laying out here in his first term in office. But he made one giant mistake with Iran. And he decided he could go in there, he could do social engineering, and he's run into a buzzsaw. I mean, the Iranians are incredibly nationalistic. It's like going up against the Vietnamese, going up against the Afghanis. You would be crazy to think that you could do social engineering in a country like that. And, you know, a lot of people talk about a land option, right? This is the idea that we're going to go in there and we're going to unseat the regime with ground forces. This, of course, is what we did in Iraq. We got rid of Saddam Hussein. We did it with large-scale ground forces. This is just simply not a viable option. There's no way you can affect regime change in a country like Iran and get a happy ending anymore. There was a chance of doing that in Afghanistan, Iraq, or Vietnam.
Or Ukraine, for that matter. I mean, there's so many, I completely agree. Your book really kind of helpfully guides people through understanding, you know, the difference between liberalism, progressive liberalism, nationalism, you know, realism, great power politics. It's one of the great thing, and one of the great things about it in terms of providing a handbook for people who are really interested in these things. I mean, I totally agree with you on the kind of social engineering point. There's a really good, there are lots of really good quotes in the book, but you mentioned Fukuyama earlier. I kind of latched onto a comment. You quote him in saying that smarter people are more liberal. to what extent is one of the challenges of efforts at liberal hegemony that other powerful nations see us Western powers as basically snobs and neo-colonials, you know, as you say, to kind of remake their states, their nations, you know, in our image?
Actually, I think, Ian, that's Steven Pinker who said that.
Ah, okay.
It wasn't Frank Fukuyama. Steve Pinker is arguing that we are getting smarter, right? This is an argument I completely reject. But his argument, Steve Pinker's argument, is that we are getting smarter, number one. And number two, as you get smarter, you become more liberal. And one could argue that this is implicit in Frank Fukuyama's piece, right? That we're getting smarter. We've had all this modernization and so forth and so on, all this higher education. And the end result is we become more liberal. And this is the reason that the future looks so bright. And of course, the Pinker argument, he's very interested in the question of of war and peace. And his argument is that as we become more liberal, which is inevitable in his story, the world will become more peaceful. Now, you could make this argument to some extent during the unipolar moment, because again, you want to remember great power politics was taken off the table. The US-Soviet competition went away, and it was the United States all by itself as a great power. Yes, there were the forever wars, but for a while you could tell yourself that we were going to win those forever wars, and we were well on our way to fostering a liberal world order. Remember when George Bush, after we invaded Iraq, landed on the carrier, the aircraft carrier, and he declared mission accomplished. This is 2003. We invade Iraq on March 19th, 2003. So shortly thereafter, I think if my memory's correct, it was in May, Bush lands on the carrier. This is a point where it looks like the United States is in the driver's seat and it's well on its way to making liberal hegemony work. There's no great power politics. Soviet Union disappeared. Russia is a basket case in 2003. Putin is only beginning to bring it back from the dead. China is not the powerhouse that it is today, back in 2003. There's no Ukraine war. There's, you know, no more wars in store in the Middle East because we've just knocked off the regime in Iraq and we're going to live happily ever after. So you could make the argument then that it was working, that the people like Steve Pinker, Frank Fukuyama looked like they had the wind at their back. But fast forward to today and look at the world around us. It does not look like Frank or Steve were correct. In fact, it looks like they were categorically wrong. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that liberal hegemony backfired, number one, and number two, great power politics is back on the table. And great power politics is a nasty business by definition, in my opinion.
Yeah. It's certainly the case. You can see it, that progressive liberalism has been almost a defining ideology that's kind of fused the foreign policy agenda of the mainstream political parties, certainly in Europe, definitely in the United Kingdom, what some people like to refer to as the Uniparty, allowing them to show a point of difference on domestic policy. But I think, you know, most people, ordinary people, spend very little time thinking about foreign affairs, you know, in my view. However, liberalism, it seems to me, is becoming increasingly contested at home, which is making it harder to promote it overseas, because our liberal foreign policy is making domestic circumstances worse for ordinary people. But I'm not yet sure that ordinary people can necessarily kind of see the link between the two, except that they are suffering. What's your sense?
Well, I think that one of the reasons we ended up with Donald Trump, and one of the reasons there's so much dissatisfaction with liberalism, is that liberalism, in addition to leading to these forever wars, has other characteristics that cause real trouble for itself on the home front. And one example of this would be immigration. If you think about how liberalism, taken to its extreme, approaches the subject of immigration, you see that it easily can lead to open borders. And how does that work? The fact is that liberalism is predicated on individual rights, human rights. And the belief is that those rights are inalienable. And that means that every person on the planet has the same rights. So when you begin to talk about individual rights that are inalienable, that apply to everybody on the planet, you go from individualism to universalism, right? And it then becomes very difficult to say that someone from a distant country who wants to come into your country can be prevented from crossing the border. Doesn't that person have the right to come to the United States or the right to come to Britain? And actually, it is liberal hegemony. It's the domination of liberal thinking in the 1990s and in the early 2000s that pushes the whole idea of open borders forward. And in here in the United States, it was the left-hand side of the political spectrum, mainly the Democratic Party, and you see this with President Biden, that was basically in favor of open borders, that was not interested in enforcing the borders. But again, this gets back to my point about the power of nationalism, right? Nationalism is the most powerful political ideology on the planet. And Americans, most Americans view themselves as Americans, and they view themselves as different from Brits, from Guatemalans, from Mexicans, from Germans, just the way Brits view themselves as different from Hungarians or Nigerians. Pick your country, right? We live in nation states where we have, and here's the key word, a national identity, a national identity. Nation state, national identity. Nationalism is a particularistic ideology. And what I'm saying to you, Ian, is if you think about it, liberalism, because of its belief in inalienable rights, rights that every person on the planet has that powerful universalistic dimension. And it's that universalistic dimension that leads to things like open borders. And once you start talking about open borders, you know, there's going to be a lot of political turmoil. Just talk to Viktor Orban about this. Viktor Orban, I mean, he's no longer in power, of course, but Viktor Orban lived in mortal fear of open borders. The last thing he wanted to do was dilute Hungarian national identity. And you see the same kind of thinking in countries like the United States and Britain. And you certainly see that in Germany today. When Angela Merkel let in all of those refugees, from a liberal point of view, she did absolutely the right thing. It looked like her behavior was clearly noble in intent. I fully understand that. But you have to understand that there is this German nation. Germany is a nation state. And you have to be very careful to control immigration into that state. Because if too many immigrants come in and the immigration process is not handled carefully and people are not integrated into the society, it's going to jump up and bite you in the hiney. And this is what happened with Trump. Trump played the immigration card to his advantage. He said that open borders is just categorically unacceptable. And most Americans agreed with that. And I have a good number of liberal friends who argued during the Biden years that Biden was remarkably foolish not to manage our borders. And by the way, I want to be very clear here. I'm a proponent of immigration. I like immigration. I just like legal immigration, and I like immigration that's managed in the context of maintaining an American identity. And if I were a Brit, I would feel the same way. Immigration is fine, but it has to be managed, has to be carefully done, because if it isn't carefully done, you undermine liberalism. See, that's the point. You end up with Donald Trump. And as I said before, I think Donald Trump is an enemy of liberalism. And by the way, to go back to Viktor Orban, I spent 3 hours talking to Viktor Orban one-on-one about these issues. And Viktor Orban clearly identifies himself as an illiberal Democrat. Right? Just think about it. He believes in democracy, but he does not like liberalism. And the reason he doesn't like liberalism is that he understands full well the tension that I'm describing.
Well, yeah, indeed. I mean, central to your kind of thesis in the book is that there is always kind of competition within any nation or state about what the rules of the game should be. And actually, politics is often, you know, defined by the competition for setting the rules, which kind of goes against this idea of universal rights in any case, because someone will always want to impose their version of the rules on people, normally, you know, the working class. I mean, on your point about immigration, I feel exactly the same way. I spent much of my life living overseas. All my best friends are neither Christian nor white, although my longest friend, he came from the Kenyan diaspora in the 1970s, never taken a penny of benefits, and I consider them as English as I am. But you know, when you talk about the difference between nations and states, I think it's really helpful for people to understand nations as identity, culture, kind of symbols, rituals, habits, you know, and that sort of thing, and states as the kind of institutions. I think that's a really kind of interesting way to kind of think about it. And what's fascinating for me kind of right now, certainly in the Ukraine context, in the European context, is that we've almost created, through our attempts at liberal hegemony in the kind of periphery of the former kind of Soviet Union, in creating the circumstances where, you know, Ukraine is now trying to develop for itself a new idea of nationhood, a kind of ethnocentric nationhood from the 20th century, at a time when its state is being shattered, you know, by the war itself that we sort of suggested it undertake for the purposes of promoting liberal, you know, hegemony across the kind of former Soviet space. I mean, do you see any signs of recognition in Europe that actually that they may well be helping to create in Ukraine a country that is neither liberal nor democratic, but which ultimately sees that it has a right to kind of a membership of the club?
Let me make just a couple points about Ukraine before I directly answer your question. First of all, it's very important to understand that the seeds of the conflict in Ukraine can be traced to liberal hegemony. And it's really all about NATO expansion. The decision to expand NATO is made, I think it's 1994, by Bill Clinton, who was then president. And the first tranche of expansion is in 99. That's when Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary come in. The second tranche of expansion is in 2004. That's when the Baltic states, Bulgaria, Slovenia, Slovakia, Romania, they all come in. That's 2004. So 94 is the decision. 99, the first tranche. 2004, the second tranche. And then 2008 is when the decision is made that they're going to bring Ukraine and Georgia in to the alliance. And of course, later that year, 2008, you get the war in Georgia, which is a direct result of this NATO decision in 2008. And then the crisis, one could even argue the war, first breaks out in Ukraine in 2014. Now, the reason, Ian, that I'm paying such careful attention to those dates is they all took place, those dates all took place during the unipolar moment. So 2014, when the war, or the crisis breaks out, it happens in unipolarity. And it's a result of liberal hegemony. You know, a lot of people think today that if you look at the Ukraine war, what the United States was really doing was it was moving the alliance eastward because what it wanted to do was deter or contain Russia. Nothing could be further from the truth. Just go back and look at the planning documents. Look at the discourse inside the Clinton administration in the 1990s. They were not viewing Russia as a threat that had to be contained. Furthermore, these were people who believed that realism was dead, balance of power politics was dead. We lived in a new world. Frank Fukuyama's mentality had pervaded penetrated the Clinton administration almost to a person. So we were basically pursuing liberal hegemony. We were trying to take this set of institutions, these political systems that we had developed in the West, the Western order from the Cold War, and move it to the East. That was the goal. It wasn't aimed at containing Russia, right? And it blew up in our face because the Russians said after 2008 that we're not going to let this happen. So that's where we are today. So liberal hegemony. Second point I would make to you, which is a very interesting point, I think. In 1993, I wrote what was, most people would have said at the time, an infamous article that appeared in Foreign Affairs in the same issue as Sam Huntington's Clash of Civilization article. In fact, his piece is the first piece and my piece is the second piece. And I made the argument, Ian, that Ukraine, which had inherited a large number of nuclear weapons when the Soviet Union broke apart. Remember, when the Soviet Union breaks apart, there are nuclear weapons left in Belarus, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and of course in Russia. And Russia gets all those weapons back. But the Ukrainians thought long and hard about keeping those weapons. And I wrote a piece that said they should keep the weapons. Now, why did I think that was the case? I was heavily informed by the fact that in eastern Ukraine, you had a significant intermingling of Russians and Ukrainians, ethnic Russians and ethnic Ukrainians. And watching what was happening at the time in the Balkans, remember the wars in the Balkans between the Croats, the Bosniaks, those are the Bosnian Muslims, and the Serbs, right? That's all about nationalism, the independence of Slovenia, what happens in Albania. You look at the Balkans wars, that's nationalism on steroids, okay? I look at Ukraine and I say to myself, there's real potential for trouble here because you have an intermingling of Ukrainians and Russians. And if the Russians invade Ukraine, you'll have a major war. And Ukraine does not have the ability to build a formidable conventional deterrent by itself. So just keep the nuclear weapons. You basically inherited them. And that will provide for deterrence. And you are likely, not guaranteed, but likely to avoid a war. That was my view. But you see, I was thinking at the time about nationalism. I was thinking about the fact that you had two different groups in the eastern part of Ukraine. And by the way, if you go back to the history of Ukraine, since it's got its independence, what you see is that you would switch back and forth between leaders who would either be pro-Russian or pro-Western. Yanukovych, who was overthrown, of course, in 2014, was widely viewed as pro-Russian. But there were others who were seen as pro-Western. So you had this real tension inside of Ukraine. But the problem that I faced in the early 90s is that nobody believed that there was any cause for concern of a conflict between Ukrainians and Russians, because we lived in a world where the liberal lens, which doesn't distinguish, it's very important to understand, the liberal lens does not distinguish between different national groups. It's very universalistic. That was the point that I made to you before. Every person on the planet has individual rights that are inalienable. The focus is on the individual. Liberalism is an individualistic ideology that has little tolerance for nationalism. So when people like me are saying, well, you know, we should worry about, those ethnic Russians and ethnic Ukrainians clashing and the Russians coming in to deal with the near abroad problem and so forth and so on. No, no, that's old thing. John, you're a dinosaur. That was the view. And I just thought it was wrong. But eventually you saw what happened. There were just real tensions there. And then the question is, what are you likely to get today once this war comes to an end? Once you get a frozen conflict, I think you're going to get a situation where the Russians control at least four oblasts that they've already annexed in eastern Ukraine. You know, the four oblasts in the east that they've annexed, plus Crimea. And they may take a few more. And then there will be, to the west of that expanded Russian state, to the west of that will be a rump Ukraine. And I believe, and I hope I'm dead wrong on this, that there will be lots of ethnic cleansing once the conflict stops. And many of the ethnic Ukrainians in the incorporated areas, the areas, the oblasts that are incorporated into Russia, will be cleansed and pushed into Ukraine. And many of the Russians in the western part of Ukraine will move to the eastern part of Ukraine, similar to what happened with regard to Turkey and Greece after World War I. Again, I hope this doesn't happen. I hope I'm dead wrong. But again, Ukraine is a place where this tension between and in many ways, this hatred between ethnic Ukrainians and ethnic Russians is quite strong and has been exacerbated by the war. Now, when I make these kinds of arguments in a place like Europe about the causes of the war, how to think about Ukrainian nuclear weapons, how to think about moving forward and so forth and so on, most people either find it hard to grasp what I'm saying or just dismiss me out of hand, because liberalism for the most part is alive and well among European elites. It's really quite amazing. the extent to which they buy the basic liberal story and the extent to which they have little interest in nationalism. And by the way, you see this, if you think about the EU, right? The EU is an international, it's a transnational institution. It's not a national institution. It's no accident, Ian, that Viktor Orban is at war with the EU and the EU is at war with Viktor Orban, right? It's that nationalism, liberalism tension. And by the way, just to take this one step further while I'm on stream of consciousness mode, Sam Huntington used to talk about Davos man. At this point in time, we could call it Davos person. Now, what exactly was Sam talking about? Sam was saying that basically what we have in the world today is that we have this international elite, right, that really sees the world in global terms or international terms and not in national terms. And what you see is that lots of people inside of particular nation states loathe these global elites. This was one of Hillary Clinton's big problems. Hillary Clinton was basically Davos woman. And by the way, Ian, I think that in a very important way, people like you and I are Davos men, right? We are thoroughly internationalized. Just look at how you were talking about yourself at the start of the show, which is no different from how I talk and think. I intermingle with people from other countries all the time, and I feel every bit as comfortable with them as I do with my fellow Americans, right? But it's just very important to understand that at the elite level during the unipolar moment, when institutions like Davos were in full swing, when institutions like the EU were in full swing, you understand that the EU is very, very much opposed to nationalism. Nationalism is anathema to the EU. But again, if you buy my argument, nationalism is the most powerful political ideology on the planet. And the question you have to ask yourself is, how does this play out over time? And I think what we have been seeing, you know, in recent years is the erosion of liberalism, the erosion of power in institutions like the EU, and the coming to the fore of nationalism. You see this with the AfD in Germany, you see with Nigel Farage in Britain, and so forth and so on. I mean, and of course, Viktor Orban, was dedicated to do everything he could to weaken the EU because he thought the EU was doing everything it could do to weaken Hungarian nationalism.
Yeah. I mean, the difference, I suppose, with you and I is that when we go overseas, we don't see ourselves as Christian missionaries trying to proselytize and totally reform the people that we meet. We meet them as equals and treat them as equals. And I think that's the difference. I think you're right. Liberal elites have a remarkable immunity to failure. No failure is too great for them to recover from and record it as a success, it seems to me. And last question, really. I mean, you speak in your book about the need for a counter elite, a new foreign policy elite that perhaps isn't elitist, but is kind of more attuned with ordinary sort of folk, you know, and their needs and how nationalism really kind of plays to the hearts and spirits of actually most people in any country. I mean, how can we do more to promote this counter elite, idea? Because I think you clearly have huge resonance. Your new people coming along the block are sort of, cutting through. But how can we become more mainstream?
Well, I think, for intellectuals like us, or public intellectuals like us, what we can do is talk about these issues and help people think them through. But I do obviously believe that ideas matter enormously and that us talking about these issues has a significant influence on how people think, and that has political consequences down the road. But beyond that, I'm not sure, how to think about this, moving forward. I would say, I wrote a talk about, I won an award, the James Madison Award, and I gave a talk on the relationship between liberalism and nationalism in the United States. And in the context of researching that talk that I gave, I discovered that not only did President Trump play the nationalism card in the 2016 election, if you go back and you look at Trump's speeches during the campaign and you look at what he said after he took office, you'll see the nationalism-liberalism dichotomy playing itself out, and Trump talking in very very nationalistic ways. And what I discovered to my utter amazement is you see the same thing in Barack Obama's talks. Go back and look at Barack Obama's speeches. And the same thing is true with Bernie Sanders. I believe that Sanders and Obama both, like Trump, understood that national identity matters greatly. American nationalism matters. You know, I often say to people, Hillary Clinton was remarkably foolish to allow President Trump, or candidate Trump, I should say, in 2016, to use the America First label against her. Anyone who's the president of the United States is going to have an America First policy. That's your job. It's part of the job description. You are the president of the United States. Just like if you're the prime minister of Britain, you have to have a Britain First foreign policy. But you see, Hillary and the vast majority of liberals, people on the political left in the United States, could not fathom adopting an America First label because these were basically Davos people. Right? That's what's going on here. And what I'm saying to you is, I don't believe that was true of Obama. Obama's a very smart man. Bernie Sanders, very smart man. Both have great noses. And they understand, right, that they live in a nation state called the United States. And if they're in charge, they have to take care of the American people first and foremost. That's their responsibility. So I think that if you look at what Sanders was saying, you look at what Obama has said, you can push nationalism forward in a positive way that doesn't conflict that much with liberalism. This is the debate that I had with Viktor Orban. See, Viktor Orban thinks that liberalism and nationalism are oil and water. They can't mix. My view is he's wrong. I understand, as I made clear to him, that there are fundamental differences between liberalism and nationalism, and there are real tensions there, but they can coexist. And if you think about it, Ian, they have coexisted in Britain and in the United States for a long time, because you and I were born into liberal nation states. We were born into nation states. You're born into Britain, I'm born into the United States. We were born into nation states. We are social animals. That's the tribe we were born into. But the countries that we were born into were also liberal. The United States is a liberal nation state. Well, not as liberal as it used to be, thanks to all of this liberal hegemony. But anyway, that's subject for a different matter. But anyway, all of this is to say that I do believe that liberalism can coexist with nationalism. And as I said to Viktor Orban, I think that if done properly, liberalism can cut against the sharp edges of nationalism, and nationalism can cut against the sharp edges of liberalism, and they can, in a very important way, reinforce each other. And I'm not being naive here, because I do understand that there is a significant tension between these two isms. But nevertheless, I think you can have a liberal nation state, as is the case with both Britain and the United States.
Well, it all comes down to coexistence and actually a return of statecraft and statespeople who actually pursue a pragmatic track rather than an ideological one in terms of their kind of foreign policy, but also in terms of their domestic policy too, and recognize that the shifting sands of what their people are feeling at any given moment. Thanks so much, John. As always, fabulous insights there. I'd recommend to everybody to read your book if you haven't already. It is a fantastic contribution and really helpful in mapping out the three isms, as you refer to them, liberalism, nationalism, and realism. Absolutely essential reading for anybody who is really interested in why we're in such a terrible state globally that we are. By now, John Mearsheimer, I really appreciate everything that you do. Thank you for your support. Thank you, everybody, for watching.